This week on the show, who watched the Oscars and who tweeted? Google changes their search results. Will content farms suffer? And is the U.S. government using social media for propaganda? Right here on This Week in Media, number 224. Hey, we're back. I'm your host, Tim Street, and joining me today is my co-host, Lon Seidman.
Hey, how are you, Tim?
Doing well, Lon. What are you working on?
Well, I just got back from the space shuttle launch. It finally went up after months of talking about it, and I have to say it was probably one of the coolest things I have ever experienced. And I've got some great video up on our website I've been keeping for the adventure. It's shuttle.localonlinenews.tv, so you can see a really cool time lapse the night before the launch, and then some 1080p video of the launch itself.
Very cool.
So it was pretty cool.
Did you see Alex while you're down there? Because we've lost Alex. I don't know where Alex is.
It's one of those things you never really know where Alex is. But
Alex Lindsay, I tell you. What are you going to do?
What are you going to do? I mean, he wasn't on the space shuttle, I can tell you that much. But that's about all I know.
There you go. And we also have a guest joining us this week, kind of a regular of the show now, David Bloom. David, how are you?
I'm good.
What's new with you?
I had a little power headache before this, but I'm glad to say that the grid in California seems to have recovered enough to allow me to take part, so I'm very grateful for that. I just don't know what happened, so...
Yeah, Lon and I were speculating why your power was out, and we were thinking maybe it was a high-speed car chase, and they ran into the telephone pole. Because that happens in L.A. more than the power going out.
It does, but, California, I guess about 10 years ago, had those huge issues. You know, they privatized a big chunk of the grid, or they took they deregulated a lot of the power grid, and for a few years there it was kind of a disaster for many of the utilities, you know, Southern California Edison and PG&E in particular, which was a big deal because you couldn't the transmission system wasn't getting power where it needed to go, and I think they've kind of fixed those issues, but it was I was having flashbacks to
Enron. That was all Enron. You know, yesterday we did have a high-speed car chase here in LA, and it was a guy like in a bathrobe and pajamas, and the cops ended up tasing him, and for a moment I thought it was Charlie Sheen when I heard about it. Because it would have been the perfect ending to this story, but oh well.
Charlie was too busy with his hookers and his non pharmaceutical pursuits.
That is non pharmaceutical pursuits. There you go. So yeah. We have a lot of news to cover on the show this week, but kind of the biggest story in town this week was definitely the Oscars, all the aftermath. There seems to be a lot of love-hate going on. People were complaining that the social network kind of fizzled. And did you guys see the show, David? Did you?
I caught a bit of it. I have to say that I was busy being dedicated to all my suddenly plentiful clients, but I caught parts of it. And then I actually fell asleep practically from the conversations by the hosts, who were less than scintillating. Beautiful and certainly accomplished in many, many ways, but there's a reason why you make a point of watching Ricky Gervais on the Golden Globes immolate everybody within 100 yards of him, and why you don't watch James Franco and Anne Hathaway try to be funny.
Yeah. Lon, did you catch it?
The Twitter stream was more entertaining to me than the actual show, and I think that was the story for a lot of people that was the case. I'd never really been into the Oscars all that much, but it was fun to just watch the whole thing. And quite honestly, I don't know if anyone can ever live up to the Twitter stream's expectations. This might very well change the media. And I did read an article somewhere, and I wish I had it handy at the moment, which I don't. But it was intriguing to hear some ideas about perhaps some of these shows should think about following what what people on Twitter are saying and adjusting for those issues. I don't know if you can stop a prepared show midstream and retool it, but I think there's a real change to what the viewing audience expects and how they can communicate that out to the rest of the world. And I don't know if that impacted viewership or not. Clearly, a lot of people did tune in. And I also think back to the horrific Super Bowl halftime show. a similar thing where pretty much the universal disdain on Twitter. So there's some things that people need to think about, and this is a good example of that.
Well, it's really interesting when you look at the Oscars. You know, for most people that watch the Oscars, they just see it as Hollywood, but in Hollywood, it's television meets film. I mean, the film industry and the television industry are two separate industries. And this is a night where they come together. It's a TV show celebrating and honoring films. And then you throw in social media on top of that, which neither film or television, to my knowledge, really has a handle on yet. And it just seemed to be like little joke here, little joke there. And there really wasn't the true interactivity that there could have been. Now, however, that said, ABC did have the all-access pass and the backstage pass. One's a site and one's an app. Did you guys check that out at all?
No, I missed that. So what was that about?
David, did
you? Yeah, well, I was aware of it. I think being male probably reduced my appetite for all things Oscar. It is essentially the thing you watch with your wife or your girlfriend as she catches the red carpet, and maybe you watch the show itself, but pretty much it's a command performance, I think, for many, certainly heterosexual males, that the extra stuff I think is really smart for ABC to do, because there is, within a certain set of their audience, a boundless appetite for this. You know, there's a reason why the local shows, the local stations, do the red carpet for 4 hours beforehand and help build this thing up before the actual award show itself. It's an interesting thing that I think we'll see more and more of as we get better integration and better understanding of how you serve specific large audiences. I mean, there's enough money, there's enough bodies there, enough eyeballs to make it worthwhile to put those overlays in there that they did. And you'll see it with the Super Bowl. You'll see it with some other event stuff. And for many of these, you're seeing the numbers actually go up. You know, even though we have these fracturing audiences, I mean, it didn't happen with the Oscars. It was down 12%, according to the Hollywood Reporter this morning, which is a whopping big number. But you look at things like the Super Bowl, it was up something like 7% this year. Some other big event kinds of programming, they're up. They're actually unifying kinds of programming, and you can wrap a lot of interesting stuff around it if you're clever. And some of these guys are kind of clever.
Yeah, I did check out the Backstage Pass app on the iPad. I can't really talk about it much because the company that I work for had something to do with it, but it was a pretty cool app, and it was interesting to see the different camera angles backstage. Although I was disappointed that I couldn't hear the control room. I could see the control room, but I couldn't hear it. But
they'd be bleeping that thing like crazy.
Yes,
that's why.
They would. For any of you who have ever been in a control room during a live show, it's kind of hanging out with a bunch of sailors.
And the word control is kind of funny because they don't have any when it comes to their vernacular, to use the Melissa Leo term.
Yeah, it gets a little wild, but a very cool start to what's going to happen in interactive TV, and I hope we get to see more of it these events progress. Moving on to our next story, Google revamps to fight cheaters. This story comes to us from the Wall Street Journal, and it talks about how Google, long considered the gold standard of internet search, is changing the secret formula it uses to rank web pages as it struggles to combat websites that have been able to game its system. No surprise there. Lon, have you been gaming the system?
I wish I knew how to, but maybe not, because if I had invested any money in it, I'd be really pissed off right now. But I think it's a good thing, because as a small content provider, we often rely on, and many people listening too, rely on Google search results to really be their main source of traffic. And when you have something like one of these content farms out there stealing keyword positions, you know, through gaming the system, through putting a lot of time, money, and resources into doing that, I see that to be a really bad thing for small people, that we can't really compete with these people with a lot of money behind them gaming Google search results. And this was a good move by Google, and this is something that they do from time to time. And I remember a period of time, maybe 8, 9, 10 years ago, when there was a lot of spam results on Google that they worked to reduce. And I think it's a good move, and it's good for real content that's out there that people work hard on. You know, one thing that I have noticed in the past is that occasionally some of our videos that we do at localonlinenews.tv get swiped up by a content farm. So we're actually seeing our own stuff. Thankfully, they're embedding the video from our YouTube or Blip site, so we're not losing the viewer count. But that was getting better traffic than the stuff we were posting ourselves. And it's to some extent, maybe you're a little bit safer being in the video production side of it versus just text. But I know of a lot of people that have seen that happen to their own text content just gets absorbed by one of these content farms.
Sure. Now, David, do you think the content farms are in trouble with this change?
It's interesting, because one of the things that one of the projects I'm in a nascent stage with right now, we've had a lot of conversation about whether the content farms, and you know, there's been a lot of declarations out of Demand Media, one of the big ones, and out of Associated Content, which Yahoo now owns, saying that you know, we're going to be fine, you know, and that in fact we're trying to get better quality content. Yeah, they're going to do some of that, but the reality is that's hard to scale, as we all know, as content geeks ourselves. It's hard to scale that. So when they say they're going to have better quality content, it's not just going to be, you know, lowest common denominator and SEO'd like crazy and to sort of, I don't even think it's fair to call it gaming the system. I mean, they're using the system that literally. Google has created a game. They've created a set of rules. Now, they keep those rules secret, and you get to figure out what those rules are, and some people have more money than others to try and figure those rules out and to hire smart people to figure them out. But you know what? This is really like a video game. It is essentially, at its basically, a video game, and we just don't know what the rules are. We get to figure them out as we go, which might be the basis for a really interesting video game now that I think about it. And so all they've done is say, you know, you get to figure these rules out, and then when you do figure them out and it skews things to your advantage, we're going to change the rules, so you got to do it all over again. And, you know, it's a temporary respite. I mean, the problem for Google is they're a big target. There's huge money there to be made. I don't think the content farms go away. I do think they evolve. I mean, we certainly see what happened with Huffington Post, which is not quite a content farm. They got some value attached to them. The IPO for Demand Media got out the door, and they actually made some money. Yahoo and Associated Content seem to think they're going to be okay, because in part, a big chunk of their content comes from or gets pushed through Yahoo. So, you know, we'll see how this works out. I'm not gonna worry too much about where Richard Rosenblatt's next meal comes from.
Well, you know, some of these sites, they're really worried that their business is being killed because of the change in Google's algorithm. And in another story from CNN.com, which is related, you know, it talks about this how they feel that Google is killing their business. And you know, it goes into more detail about the content farms and how, you know, sites like Demand Media, AOL, Mahalo, and Huffington Post have been accused of tactics of, you know, kind of manipulating the system. There was something with a story about the Super Bowl Slate.com. Lon, were you aware of that?
The Super Bowl Slate.com?
Yeah, Slate.com media critic Jack Schaefer called the greatest example of SEO whoring all the time. I don't know. it just, to me, it seems like, you know, people want quality information. They when they're searching for something, they want what they want when they want it. And sometimes they get the answer to their question, but they get it in a low form of quality, whether that's a video or content that's been scraped someplace else. But as a viewer, as a consumer, do you really care as long as you get the answer to your question?
Right. I think it varies based on the person too. What they're looking for. You're right. I mean, sometimes answer.com gets me the zip code that I was looking for some city, and in other cases, I want something more in depth and have to go hunt further for it. I think from Google's perspective, they have some serious competition now in Bing and Facebook for that matter, where there's essentially human curation putting together content that's getting put in front of people. So to some extent, the higher quality content is coming out of Twitter and Facebook because that's the place where humans have looked at it and said, hey, this is something you should really check out, versus some automated instruction as to how to brush your dog or something like that. And I think Google sees that as a real competitive issue, and they want to make sure that their search results are as good or as close to as good as what people are talking about, perhaps in some of these social networking sites. I mean, in my mind, there's two different tracks here, but I think for Google, they don't want to become irrelevant because it's very easy in this new economy to become irrelevant very quickly.
Well, that kind of leads us to our next story in terms of social media and getting people to do things that you want them to do. According to PCWorld.com, there's an army of fake social media friends to promote propaganda. It's recently been revealed that the U.S. government contracted H.B. Gary Federal for the development of software which could create multiple fake social media profiles to manipulate and sway public opinion on controversial issues promoting propaganda. So, David, do you think the enemy here is engaging in social media and the U.S. Army should get involved, or is this a slippery slope?
Well, yes. I mean, the reality is, if you are trying to do intelligence efforts, one of the things you should be doing is looking where the people are and looking at the unfiltered conversations that they tend to have. And, you know, it's one of the things that gets really interesting. This steps from here to Egypt and Tunisia. One of my clients, a couple guys who've written a couple pretty fascinating books about millennials and technology, communications technology, had got a piece of theirs up on Huffington Post the day of the Egypt resolution when Mubarak stepped down, and they got it just exploded for them. But the reality is that people are talking about this stuff. They are showing who they are, but the bad guys are watching this stuff. And, you know, we certainly hope the U.S. government's good guys, but, you know, there's not everybody's perfect there, as things like Watergate showed. They are going to be looking at these conversations. They are going to be looking on the social networks. We saw with, was it Libya, I guess, because they knew that the government was going to be monitoring Facebook and Twitter and their Arabic language equivalents, there was a guy who got 137,000 followers on a dating site, a Muslim dating site. And that was the way he communicated in code on a dating site, because they knew they were going to be looking on the Facebook stuff. Yes, these guys should be there looking, because there are issues. We do see bad actors all the time, you know, plotting and talking, stuff like that. This is a natural extension of it. But it's another reminder, I think, that we need to be careful how we're communicating and what we're communicating. It's not just bosses looking. It's not just credit agencies. It's not just, the story about lawyers now using social networks, people off of jury panels to see if they've got biases or they're talking inappropriately about a trial. I mean, this is our megaphone, and people are having to learn to shut up sometimes.
Lon, have you learned to shut up?
No. But, you know, I think David raises a good point, that this is a public forum. So if you don't want people to know what's on your mind, don't share it on Facebook, because what's private today is public tomorrow. And I think that's the first thing that people need to think about. And the other side of it is that, you know, this is a medium, and governments and corporations and individuals try to influence that medium all the time. And we see that through the fact that most companies and most governments have a large number of people whose job it is to influence the media to tell their side of the story. So to some extent, that's not anything new. You know, propaganda is a whole other story, but you know, I would need to see a little bit more evidence that the government is trying to manipulate at least its own citizens. I mean, clearly there's a lot of public relations out there and whatnot. One thing that I have noticed on my Facebook, and in fact I turn my Facebook friends only, only people that I know. And I hid my profile from searches, but still I am getting people, I have no idea who these people are. Every day friending me, and these aren't listeners either, these are people that are connected to, that have friended other people that I know that friend everybody, right. And it's I don't know who they are, I don't know what they're about, they're never really posting anything, I don't friend them, but there's clearly, you know, either they're real people or they're not, who knows, but to get to that extent, I think it's important for people to have their own to be careful and not just open yourself up to the world and don't share things that you don't feel appropriate sharing. The other point though is email, which we rarely look at sometimes, but you know, those things that people forward around, it's amazing how even incorrect information becomes truth after a while because they got it via email from some friend of theirs. And I think these email chain letters that go around are actually a lot more influential than social media is at the moment to some extent. And just following Snopes.com gives you a real idea as to what's percolating out there.
Sure. There's some more in this story where they go on and talk about how leaked emails show how names can be cross-referenced across social media sites to collect information on people and then use to gain access to those social circles. So kind of what you were talking about. And these emails also talked about how Facebook could be used to spread government messages. There's kind of a highlighted area that we have here. Even the most restrictive and security conscious of persons can be exploited through the targeting and information reconnaissance phase. A person's hometown and high school will be revealed, and an adversary can create a classmates.com account at the same high school and year and find out people you went to high school with that do not have a Facebook accounts, then create the accounts and send friend requests. So it's interesting how sneaky these guys really are, but that's what we pay them for, right? I mean,
right.
They are our government.
And we are spending, I think, $80 billion, I think was the number that finally got attached, $80 billion a year on intelligence gathering. So mm-hmm. We ought to get our money's worth. At least we should use some of the free tools out there, right?
And,
more Hootsuite.
And speaking of free tools, Disney acquires Togetherville.
I thought you were going to talk about Charlie Sheen, but
same thing. Disney acquires Togetherville, a social network for kids under 10. This story comes from the Hollywood Reporter, and talks about how Walt Disney has acquired Togetherville. It's a social network for children under the age of 10 and their parents. This is kind of interesting. I mean, Disney has already bought Club Penguin, which was, you know, kids to play by themselves, build a little igloo, decorate their igloo, decorate their character, and then pay for the service. But Togetherville provides tools that allow parents to interact with and monitor their kids. For example, parents approve children's friends. Meanwhile, children can interact with friends, exchange gifts, play games, watch videos, and create art. They can also comment on or heart friends' activities, update their status with pre-screened phrases such as "Who's going to see Diary of a Wimpy Kid?" or "Ace the test, oh yeah." Are you guys think that Disney's going to rebrand this site, Lon? Do you think they'll stay with Togetherville? Do you think this site will stick around?
Well, I mean, if they have users that are used to going to that address, definitely. I think we might see a lot more Disney cartoons getting attached to it, just and Disney Channel for that matter. I don't know how old this thing skews, but clearly Disney has a real lock on not only the little kids but also the preteens also. So. You know, there's a lot of potential there, and I think anything for parents where they feel like maybe there's a safe harbor for their kids to play around online would be helpful. But I don't know, I don't have kids yet, but my plan when I do is maybe to let them go outside and interact in person. That might be a little bit more fun, but we'll see. I mean, it to some extent, I think having you know, introducing kids to these tools is important. But I think we need to be careful too that even with all this parental control, it's not hard to give out information that might be something you don't want to share.
Yeah, they can go to classmates.com and go to their preschool and exactly. find the kids that they went to preschool with.
Class of 2072, right?
Yeah. Now, David, this is an ad-free environment, and it looks like they brought in the LinkedIn co-founder Reid Hoffman and Second Life co-founder Corey Andrejka. I think that's how you say it. And they're advisory on the advisory board for this. Mm-hmm. What do you think Disney's going to be doing with this thing?
Well, I mean, you probably remember the pretty substantial overhaul that Bob Iger put their whole digital side through last year. Most of their hierarchy on the Disney Interactive side left. They brought in, they bought Playdom for what was it, $500 million, and they put that guy, head of Playdom, in charge of all their gaming side, and got rid of the guy who'd been in charge of their gaming operations. They went from being kind of focused on kind of the traditional console, $60 or AAA title, and or the Nintendo DS $30 title, to more casual games, more massively multiplayer games targeted to specific audiences that Disney knows well. That's clearly where they're going. This acquisition, I think, is of a piece with that. So you get the moms, you get the kids, you get the tweens and the less than tweens. Those are audiences Disney knows very well. And importantly, audiences trust Disney to not screw it up with them and to not, they've got to walk very carefully, but I think that they're probably as good as anybody at doing that and have been doing it for many, many decades. So I'm not too worried about that, but it's of a piece with a pretty substantial sea change in the way Disney is approaching the game business, who they're trying to talk to, and how they're doing it. So this is just another card in the hand that they've been dealing themselves over the last 8 months, I guess. So I think it's going to be really interesting where they go with it. I think it's actually, to my mind, makes more sense than trying to create a $50 million AAA console title that is going to maybe sell a million units, but it might make some money, but might also be a strikeout, as they found out, I think, with Kingdom Hearts 2. So,
well, you know, any TWIM episode wouldn't be a TWIM episode unless we talked about something Apple. So our next story comes from Mac Rumors. iPad 2 is rumored that it will be revealed maybe this week.
I think tomorrow, actually,
tomorrow,
is the day, right?
Yeah.
Tomorrow.
Yeah.
That's the assumption, is tomorrow. It's, there's a special event tomorrow.
So
we just don't know what it is.
Lon, if there's a new iPad out that works out in the sun, are you going to get it?
You remembered. Yes. If it works out in the sun, that'll be the tipping point for me, because I was in the sun for the last couple of days in Florida, which was wonderful. Now that I'm back in freezing cold Connecticut.
I was going to say, what sun do you have to worry about in Connecticut, for goodness sake? Even when it's
nothing.
Sunny, it's not sunny.
Well, yeah, the snow reflects off this. Yeah, right. The snow reflects off of it, too. You can't look at it with the snow either. That's been the big thing for me. Although, I don't know, quite honestly, what they can really do to this thing to really get me to buy another one. That would actually do it for me. But I think it's pretty good as is. I mean, I'm not missing having a camera on it. I mean, I could see that being something that some people might want to have. I think, and this is all, again, speculation, but I think we're going to see more on the software side. Sure, a little bump in RAM, maybe a bump in processor speed, but the software might really be the story out of tomorrow. And Apple's, almost reinvented the iPad once already in just the short year it's been out. Well, I think the bottom line for tomorrow is announcement, and actually by the time people are listening to this, it's going to be already announced. But I think the bigger story here will be the software. And we've seen with the iPad that they've already reinvented it, really, in the first year of its existence. The difference between the shipping iOS 3 that came on the iPad to the version 4 that we that we have now is pretty substantial and really increased the usability of the device, the multitasking, and a couple of other nice little features. You know, Alex likes the folders, which I agree with as well. So perhaps we might see more of the story being software than the hardware. You know, there will be a bump in processor speed and perhaps RAM and maybe a camera on the front and back, but the usability for me has always been where it's been at. And you know, if it is sunlight compatible, I'm for it. So let's wait and see.
So David, do you have an iPad? Are you going to get one?
I have a first generation iPad, a hand-me-down from my partner. So it's not, it's only Wi-Fi enabled. It doesn't have the 3G. But it's interesting what Lon has to say, because A, he lives in a place where the sun comes out three times a year, whether it needs to or not. B, I live in a place where the sun doesn't go away, it feels like. And even without 3G, even in the burning hot sun year-round of Southern California, and God bless it for that, though we've had more clouds than ever, I got to tell you, I find lots of ways to use it that don't require me to be out sitting in the sun and not being able to see through the reflection, including, I might add, when I wake up at 5 a.m. and just want to read in bed. And I can do it without turning on the light and blinding myself. And it's the exact opposite. So most of the times when I would want... what I would want to use the iPad, I find its glossy screen not an issue. And I would say that what's coming down tomorrow sounds interesting. I think to me the most interesting thing, I just plunked down a big 99 cents to get the full version of FaceTime for my Mac installed this week. You know, they just released that, and that's clearly Apple's big play in the conferencing space. So they almost assuredly will have a camera. Whether they have front and back or not is kind of less important, but I suspect it will be front and back. It almost definitely will be a faster processor. It probably will be a little bit slimmer and lighter to try and deal with some of those issues. But you know, the key is they have a machine that, because they buy in vast scale bulk amounts of the supplies they need, including particularly for these screens, no one's going to be able to compete with them on a feature for feature and price basis. They are hundreds of dollars less than the other ones that are coming out that are roughly the same quality. They've gotten back up to, if you know, it was funny because Zoom came out, the Motorola box or tablet just came out a week and a half ago, and every review said, great device, don't buy it yet. Wait to see what Apple does in a week and a half, and then you can decide. And probably what they're going to decide is, I'm going to pay $200 more for the Zoom and not get as many apps and functionality, and I won't be able to get supply that I'd like either, because Apple's locked up so much of the supply of these crucial components that everybody needs for their devices. So Apple's in a really great strategic standpoint. They've caught up from any challenge that might come on a feature basis, and they got them beat on price. I mean, it's kind of scary how well they've executed on this.
Yeah, for me, I use the iPad every day. Yep. For the work that I do with MDialog, and it's such a great device for doing demos, you know, for showing people how they can, you know, serve video on a mobile device. It's so elegant, and it's really fun to give a demo on an iPad. I love it for consuming media. I don't like it so much for creating media. I don't like doing email on it. Copy and paste is really not fun yet. I mean, I'm not as quick with it as I am with a MacBook Pro. So to me, you know, I'll probably get a new one just because I need to have the latest and greatest. And you know, I'm one of those shiny object people. you know, I'm excited. I'm looking forward to it. I think that's about as much time as we have for this show. Just a reminder, all listeners, please become our friend on the TWIM Facebook page at www.facebook.com/pages/thisweekinmedia. Lon, where can people find you at online?
You can find me on Twitter at LONSEIDMAN, and you can scroll through my musings from NASA. So I had some, it was such a great time, really incredible thing, really incredible what they are doing as an agency, government agency, to get real people into their facilities to share their experiences with the space shuttle program and as it's concluding. So it's been a really great experience. So check that out, LONSEIDMAN on Twitter. I also just picked up a Chevy Volt also, so it's been a real geeky week for me. So I'll be sharing some experiences driving an electric car as well.
Very cool. David, where can people find you?
On Twitter, at David Blum, BLOOM, and at david@deepstrat.com, one of my consulting firms that focuses on digital media. You can drop me a line there. And out and about.
And if you're looking for me, Tim Street, you can find me at mdialogue.com or check me out on Twitter, 1TimStreet on Twitter. This mess you've been listening to was recorded on March 1st, 2011. We are over and out.